This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society. Community or chaos, made possible by support from the Peace and Disarmament Education Trust.
Welcome to Community or Chaos, friends. Good to be on again, and we're talking with Robert Patman, which is always a pleasure. He's the leading New Zealand professor of politics, particularly foreign relations. And he's always got something reasonably wise to say. Robert, how does the war in Gaza endanger international rule and international rules-based order and the very idea of human rights and human value? And could New Zealand have done more to oppose Israel's war on Gaza, which is at the very least feels like ethnic cleansing?
Marvin, it's a pleasure to be with you. That's quite a big question, but let's unpack it. First of all, I think one cannot underestimate the damage that the United States has done to itself by what I think is the mishandling of the Gaza conflict. It should be recalled a horrendous terrorist attack by Hamas on Israel prompted Mr. Netanyahu to declare what he called a policy of mighty vengeance. At the same time, the United States repeatedly said it had Israel's back and declared a policy of unconditional support for Israel's right of self-defense. That worried me from the outset, as did worry many other people, because we all know the right of self-defense is not limitless. And it soon became apparent that Israel's right of self-defense didn't seem to make any distinction between civilians and what might be described as military targets in the very densely populated Gaza Strip. So I think what happened at an early stage, and this is why Mr. Biden began to lose support, particularly amongst young people in the United States and elsewhere, was that the response to the terrorist attack by Hamas was somewhat indiscriminate and overwhelming, and it smacked of collective punishment against many Palestinians which were not involved in the terrorist attack. And of course, a key principle of counter-terrorist strategy is you always distinguish between innocent civilians and those who were involved in perpetrating terrorism. I think it was quite clear within a few days that despite a warning from Nanaia Mahuta, the former foreign minister, that Israel had the right of self-defense, providing it was conducted with in conformity with humanitarian law, it was quite clear that Israel was not doing that. And the fact that the United States has subsequently vetoed three attempts to initiate an immediate and lasting ceasefire in Gaza, I think, has put the United States at odds with much of the you know, probably more than 160 countries in the UN General Assembly. So I think the United States has diminished its claim to uphold a rules-based order because it hasn't been walking the talk in Gaza. Yes, the Houthis have acted in a lawless fashion in response to the Gaza situation. But we can't be selective about international law. You can't just uphold it in the Red Sea. You have to also uphold it in Gaza. After all, 31,000 Palestinians, many of whom are civilians, are dead. And the world has largely watched. So I can't stress enough that I think the United States has undermined its claim that it is the major defender of the international rules-based order. And that in turn has implications for things like AUKUS, because AUKUS was set up, this enhanced security arrangement between the US, the UK and Australia, was set up in the Indo-Pacific to, the official rationale was to defend the rules-based order against possible challenges to that order. And of course, the major challenger was perceived to be China. So the failure of the US to uphold the rules-based order has actually played into the hands of authoritarian states like Iran and China. Where has New Zealand been in this? We've been remarkably tongue-tied in standing up for humanitarian law and international law generally. In the UN, we've done the right thing on a number of occasions. On 27th of October, we were the only member of the Five Eyes to vote for an immediate humanitarian truce. Then on the 12th of December, we co-sponsored a resolution which was supported by, in the General Assembly, by more 160 countries, which called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. So, nevertheless, despite indicating that we wanted a ceasefire, we responded to the request by the United States, which had been effectively defying New Zealand's diplomacy in the UN. We responded positively to a request to send a small NZDF force to quell the illegal activities, or try to deter the illegal activities of the Houthi rebels in the Red Sea. So our policy is diplomatically in the UN, I think, is reasonably satisfactory. I'm pleased to note that by late February, New Zealand was joined by Australia and Canada in now demanding a lasting ceasefire. So our policies evolved, but it's always, I think, been in substantive terms in support of a ceasefire. But it worries me that we haven't spoken out. This is a country which did not hesitate to stand up to the United States over non-nuclear power, over non-nuclear security. It didn't hesitate to say no to the Bush administration when it legally invaded Iraq. But I think, and I don't just put the blame on the present government, I thought immediately after the Hamas attack and the early indications that the Israelis were responding in a disproportionate manner, I think that the outgoing Prime Minister, Mr. Hipkins, and the incoming Prime Minister, Mr. Luxon, should have issued a joint statement calling on all concerned to respect humanitarian law, and certainly conform with the laws of war, and that clearly hasn't happened. So, I think you know, it's disappointing that New Zealand has been so subdued on this issue. I'd like to have seen us speaking out on this issue, because I think there is a danger, and certainly many young people in New Zealand believe this, that we are seen as complicit in what's happening. And that is, you know, there is a tendency in New Zealanders to believe that we're a long way from where the action is in Gaza. But in fact, we live in an interconnected world. New Zealand gets 20% of its energy, its oil, from the Middle East, which is refined in Singapore. So we do have a big stake in the outcome. And I'm just a bit disappointed that we haven't upheld what I call New Zealand respect for fairness and the rule of law. We have a huge stake in the rule of law in globally, and it may be all right for New Zealand. It may be okay from the American point of view to be selective about international law. But for smaller powers like New Zealand, they can't afford that luxury. And one lesson about from the Christchurch terror was that we have to speak out when international law is being breached in a way which could generate more terrorism.
I actually wonder about sending even a few troops to the Red Sea in support of American action to there because of this, because of what's going on in Gaza.
Can you just say that again, Marvin? I didn't hear the first part of your question.
Sending even a few troops to the Red Sea. I think it's the Red Sea.
Yes.
Yeah. Because of what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, well, I think there was two aspects to that. First of all,
I mean, they're two different things, I realize.
Well, the six personnel sent are intelligence people, and they're helping the UK and the US target Houthi bases in the Yemen. To date, that strategy doesn't seem to have worked. The Houthis do not seem to be deterred by strikes involving mainly by the US and the UK, but supported by New Zealand, Australia and Canada. That's one thing. We've committed a small NZDF team to assist with that targeting. The jury's out whether that strategy is going to work. Second thing is the government claimed there was no connection between the lawlessness in Gaza, which has led to the loss of so many innocent lives, and the Houthi response in the Red Sea. There clearly is a link. And the Americans acknowledged that at the outset when they started placing warships in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea in anticipation from a possible reaction to their own admittedly unconditional support for Israel. So, you know, when we heard this government, our government led by Chris Luxon, and the Foreign Minister, Winston Peters, repeat British talking points that there was no connection between the Gaza situation and the Red Sea situation, that made no sense and didn't persuade public opinion here.
What comes next?
What comes next?
Yeah.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? We have an extraordinary situation at the moment where the US, the Biden administration, envisages, as does New Zealand, a two-state solution whereby Israel can achieve greater security for its people in return for the end of occupation of Palestinian territories and the Palestinians achieving statehood. But the problem is the Netanyahu government doesn't share that aspiration. So we find ourselves in a very odd situation where the United States is providing substantial amounts of arms to a country which is using those arms for purposes which the donor country does not share. Netanyahu has made it quite clear he doesn't envisage a Palestinian state, and he's grateful for American armed support, but he doesn't share the American vision under the Biden administration for the day after. So I can't think of any other country in history which has given arms for purposes which it actually opposes.
It's interesting. When America in other countries wants a certain policy, they've gone to great lengths to get it, particularly in Latin America, but other places too. And Biden may be losing as much support in America as he is gaining or keeping support of some of the Jewish community. A lot of young people will be questioning what they're going to do when election time comes, which is kind of sad. I mean, scary, actually, when you consider the alternative.
I think Mr. Biden's run until the Gaza crisis, he seemed to be in a position where his administration would probably comfortably ride out the electoral challenge from Mr. Trump. But I think Gaza has had unpredictable consequences to the administration. They probably assumed, Marvin, the Biden administration probably assumed that the safest thing to do at the beginning of the, you know, when the 7th of October occurred at the beginning of the crisis, well, it wasn't the beginning of the crisis, at that point in the crisis, that the safest thing to do was not to leave the administration vulnerable to criticism from the Republican opposition that they hadn't done everything possible to help Israel, because they feared probably being politically outflanked, that the Republicans could say that America had not done enough to help a great strategic ally, Israel. So they gave unconditional support. The problem was, for the administration, they thought they did the safe political thing in Washington, but they quickly lost control of the narrative. Why? Because many young people do not rely on mainstream media, such as CNN and Fox, for their news. They get it from a variety of sources, including Al Jazeera, which has given some of the, you know, which is coverage of the crisis has been quite thorough, quite compelling, and graphic. And the reaction in the United States has been extraordinary. For the first time in recent history, sympathy for the Palestinians has exceeded sympathy for Israel's plight after the 7th of October.
I suspect this includes a fair number of younger Jewish people.
It does, and that's very important, because that is what is astonishing, in my view, as a non-American, about Biden's blanket support for Netanyahu. There's no love lost between Biden and Netanyahu. And he knew full well, in fact, he publicly criticized Netanyahu's policies before the 7th of October. Mm. He was very critical. Mm. President Biden publicly criticized Netanyahu's attempt to constitutionally interfere with the independence of the Israeli judiciary, which led, of course, to weekends of protests, week in, week out in Israel. So that was very surprising that Mr. Biden gave unqualified support to leadership, which many Americans regard as far right and extremist in Israel.
The only country that has real leverage over Israel is the United States. But the United States, Israel couldn't, they'd be in trouble in weeks, in a very short time.
I would say within days. I think there's a precedent. I mean, the Americans have tremendous leverage in this situation. 4/5 of the weapons that have killed Palestinians in Gaza since the 7th of October are American. And America finds itself, you know, deeply mired in a situation in which there's been war crimes. And this still doesn't seem to shake the resolve of the Biden administration for sticking with Israel, despite the fact they don't agree with Mr. Netanyahu's vision of what victory looks like. It's very, to non-Americans, the situation seems extraordinary. And as this crisis has unfolded, I think America and Israel have become more diplomatically isolated. There's no doubt about it. Most European countries, in fact, the leader of the EU, Ursula von der Leyen, was very supportive of Israel at the outset, but the Europeans now seem to be limiting their support now for Israel. It was very striking that Joseph Borrell, the high foreign policy spokesperson for the EU, recently visited Washington and said quite bluntly to the Biden administration, this can't go on. It remains to be seen.
Even Germany's been critical recently.
Yes, yes. And Germany was very supportive at the outset for Israel. So Olaf Scholz recently visited Israel and also delivered quite a tough message. But this is belated. And unfortunately, the longer this goes on, more and more people are being killed. And it's a humanitarian catastrophe, Marvin, of almost unprecedented proportions. We have now, according to the UN, in the last 24 hours, we now have at least a quarter of the population now facing and are in serious danger of starvation. And we have the disturbing scenes of children dying from malnutrition. So, and yet there's no signs that the Biden administration, to come back to your point, will use its leverage.
Well, that makes them responsible.
Sorry?
A refusal of the United States to use their leverage makes them responsible by, you know, co-responsibility.
It does in the eyes of many people watching this. And the other thing is the Americans, the position looks very curious. As the Washington Post recently pointed out, the administration is coming up with airdropping meals, 38,000 meals, which are a drop in the ocean. And they're also talking about building a pier, which will take 2 months to build with no certainty how the pier will actually deliver food more effectively than it's being currently blocked.
You can starve to death in 2 months.
Sorry?
You can starve to death in 2 months if you're already hungry.
The worry amongst the humanitarian aid agencies is, I mean, Palestinians are dying in large numbers every day.
I mean, if they had a ceasefire right now, it wouldn't be that easy to get the food to them in time.
No, the most effective way is to have a lasting ceasefire and Israel to end its restrictions.
Yeah, well, that's the only way that you're going to avoid famine.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I mean, that you mentioned about the leverage the U.S. has in this situation. It's really substantial. I think if Netanyahu was told by Mr. Biden enough is enough, he would not be able to politically ignore that message. And secondly, on a practical level, this war is costing Israel quite a lot of money, and I don't think he can go it alone. He says that he will ignore pressures, but that's... a degree of political bluff, which is designed to bolster support in Israel for his current position. There is an example of when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 and Reagan decided that the invasion was counterproductive and decided to stop supporting it. Menachem Begin, the then Israeli leader, quickly changed course once America made it clear it would no longer back the invasion.
Well, Israel would actually absolutely have to change course if America cut their aid off.
One would think so, but the Biden administration seems to believe that it's just a step too far to take that risk, particularly in an election year. And as I say, I think they're in a position now where they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. Mr. Biden had to be much more decisive early on. In retrospect, I think the big mistake by the Biden administration was not its support for Israel, but its unconditional support for Israel. It should have conditioned its support for Israel on the observance of humanitarian laws and, as in any good counter-terrorist campaign, protection of civilians. Now, the counter-argument is, but Hamas hide amongst the civilian population. There is some truth in that, but the fact is that is not a reason to kill large numbers of innocent people who had nothing to do with the attack on the 7th of October.
To an outsider, it feels like collective... trying to collectively... punish people, collective punishment.
Yeah, which is illegal under international law.
And also it feels, at the very least, like ethnic cleansing.
It's very difficult to fully understand Mr. Netanyahu's claim that they're doing their utmost to protect civilians. I haven't heard any apologies from the Israeli government for killing civilians. 13,500 children, which had, by definition, nothing to do with the attack of the 7th of October, have died. 70% of residential buildings have been damaged or even leveled. And since the 7th of October, the whole of Gaza has been subject to a cutoff of electricity, food, and water. Again, that is illegal under international law. So it's a very difficult thing to explain. And the other thing is, we've got to say, is the ever greater application of military force the key? Mr. Netanyahu says that he's interested in the annihilation of Hamas.
But that, in reality, that almost means like the annihilation of Gaza.
Well, the other thing is, is that a strategy? Because let's be quite clear about this. In a war on terror, as America has experienced firsthand, every time you take a civilian life, you politically boost the people you're trying to undermine.
Or you're going to create more terrorism. There's no question about that.
Well,
in the long run, more hatred anyway.
One commentator said recently, has Israel's 5 months bombardment in both the air and ground offensive on Gaza made Israel less or more secure? And at the moment, I'm not convinced it's made Israel more secure. If one of us had a family member who had nothing to do, might even be an opponent of Hamas, and they were killed in the course of this anti-Hamas campaign, then those surviving members of the family would not be well disposed towards the Netanyahu government.
Or toward the United States.
No. So we may have, the fundamental problem here is political. There's no military solution. I said, I know it's easy to be wise after the event, but I did speak out strongly immediately after this when Mr. Netanyahu started speaking about annihilating and exterminating Hamas. That is an engineering approach. It assumes if you only remove certain individuals, then all will be fine. It won't be. The problem is political, and it comes back to Israel's trying to achieve a balance or a reconciliation between Israel's desire for greater security, and I understand that desire, but we also have to understand the Palestinian desire for greater political self-determination and statehood.
The problem is that Israel really doesn't, the powers that be in Israel really don't want two states. They want to dominate. I mean, to have two states would mean that the settlers, many of them illegal on the West Bank, would have to withdraw.
Yes, and there's 700,000 illegal settlers there.
And
they've also occupied much of East Jerusalem, encroached upon the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and this is all, according to international lawyers, contrary to Resolution 242 passed in 1967. So, I suppose what Netanyahu is trying to do, he believes, apparently, if he opposes a Palestinian state, which he did. And by the way, Mr. Netanyahu treated Hamas as an Israeli asset. And publicly said so because he believed that Hamas was a divisive force amongst the Palestinians and therefore was he saw it as an ally
because they didn't have to negotiate
the Palestinian state. Of course, that's come back to bite him. But it's worth keeping in mind that Mr. Netanyahu's consistently opposed the Oslo process in the 90s and has opposed a Palestinian state since. And he doesn't make any bones about it. He's not talking about creating a Palestinian state the day after. So this is what makes it so puzzling when we hear Mr. Biden and Mr. Blinken say it's imperative that the Palestinians have statehood and it's imperative that Gaza is not reoccupied by Israel, because that is not what Mr. Netanyahu is saying. So this continuation of support seems puzzling given the gulf between Washington and Tel Aviv at the moment.
It's hard to see any good end out of this, really. I mean,
well, politics is an unpredictable business.
That a two-state solution is probably more likely than it was 6 months ago.
Well, one thing about it is that the United States has started talking about a two-state solution. Before this crisis, they were talking about, not about the Palestinians, but they were talking about Israel normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia and many of the other Arab countries around the region, which, of course, was something that Hamas was determined to prevent and may have been part of the motivation for the terrorist attack. But they also, this should be pointed out, there is a context. I'm not condoning what Hamas did. It's absolutely shocking and appalling. And it's the Palestinians that are paying the biggest price for the Hamas terrorist attack. But the fact that Gaza has been under siege, under a blockade, I should say, for more than 16 years prior to the attack, that created the conditions in which Hamas have had some leverage. Hamas presents itself as a major opponent of Israeli occupation. And that's the crucial issue that needs to be tackled. Can this occupation continue? If there's going to be a two-state solution, then the occupation will have to end.
I don't have a crystal ball.
Well, nor do I, but I mean, I'm an optimist by nature. I'm hoping that there is signs of growing opposition to Mr. Netanyahu's government in Israel, and there are many decent people in Israel and in the Palestinian territories who do want peaceful coexistence. And unfortunately, to date, extremist voices in both the Palestinian community and in Israel, in the present government, have dominated much of the debate. And the fact that I'm just trying to think of his name. Perhaps you can remind me, Marvin, the Democrats' congressional leader.
Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders?
No,
somebody Chuck. I know who you mean, Chuck.
You know the gentleman. He's a senior, well-respected
senior
politician.
Leader of the Democrats in the Senate.
Yes, but he has called for Netanyahu to stand down, and that and for elections. So that's quite a significant step.
Yep.
What I'm saying here is that with a different government in Israel, in light of what's happened, it's very important the hostages are released. There seems to be negotiations going on at the moment between Qatar, Egypt, Israel's now involved in negotiation, and the US, and there seems to be some movement towards a temporary ceasefire of about 40 days. But I'm not sure if that's viable. Maybe the Americans take the view that they should accept the Israeli demand for a temporary ceasefire under Netanyahu and hope to lengthen it once the ceasefire kicks in. But they're going to need more than 40 days to rebuild Gaza and get people fed.
The thing about 40 days and Netanyahu is that he knows that once he is no longer prime minister, his own security is very insecure, I would say, because he's under court orders for corruption. And he would be.
That's correct, yes. And I think.
Which is one reason he wanted to do away with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a difficult spot because, in a sense, politically, and many Israelis point this out, Netanyahu needs to keep the conflict going. He needs to be a war leader because that prevents him from facing some of the consequences which may hit him as soon as there is some sort of sustained ceasefire. And you're quite right, he's facing some court proceedings, and his poll ratings are looking pretty low. So he may not fancy his chances once there is, you know, a situation where we can begin to look to the future. But it's at the moment, it's, you know, we shouldn't, the thing that I think we shouldn't lose sight of, Marvin, is the situation in Gaza is a stain on humanity. It represents a crisis of humanity. The world has watched while many innocent lives have been wiped out, and it points to the impotence of the UN Security Council, an institution set up to prevent precisely this sort of situation. And yet it's been thwarted by the use of the veto. I think one of the questions is not just about the settlement of reconciling Israel's aspirations for greater security with the Palestinian desire for statehood. That's one part of the equation. But there's another part of the equation that needs to be considered in light of this crisis, and that is the UN Security Council cannot continue to stagger on in this dysfunctional way. And in a sense, Gaza is only the latest in a long line of crises in which the UN Security Council has been left impotent and rudderless and unable to do anything. And I think, of course, for New Zealand, going back to Peter Fraser in the 40s, there's always been a a deep-seated concern about the use of the veto. I think the veto now, instead of helping to bring about international security, is actively destabilizing global security in the 21st century.
Well, it certainly inhibits the UN from doing their job.
Well, they can't do their job. I mean, and you know, and no one's more frustrated than the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. The UN is only as strong or as weak as its key member states allow it to be. And we have five states which have a privilege and a perk that the rest don't. And they can block anything they don't like. The problem is, and this is the big difference that has occurred over 80 years, the difference between now and when the veto was introduced is that when the veto was introduced immediately after the Second World War, there was an expectation, A, that great powers could cooperate, and B, they could actually help resolve the world's problems. In the 80 years, fast forward 80 years on, internationally, what we've seen is that while great powers can be spoilers, they can't fix problems on their own. The United States can block the will of two-thirds of the UN General Assembly, but it can't impose its own solution in the situation in Gaza. Russia can block resolutions condemning its invasion of Ukraine, but it can't actually impose its own solution on Ukraine. Ukrainians are not having it. So the list goes on. Today we're confronted with many problems which are too big for superpowers to solve. And something's got to give. At the moment, we're falling between two stools where great powers can use the veto to block international resolutions or resolutions to solve solve problems internationally, which they don't like. They can block them. But on the other hand, they can't unilaterally fix these transnational security problems. They can't fix climate change. They can't fix COVID-19. They can't fix unilaterally problems of the extended or expanded global economy. So there's got to be some recognition within the Security Council that they are dysfunctional, that they are not doing the job they should be. And it's up to the majority in the General Assembly to start pressing the case. There is a solution, by the way, a possible solution, I would say, Marvin. I think it's futile to demand that the permanent five give up this lovely privilege they have of blocking anything they don't like, which is very exclusive and confined to them, which has had which has wreaked havoc internationally, of course. What's the alternative? Well, one possibility, I think, emerged during the Gaza crisis. And that is when, on the 12th of December, more than two-thirds of the General Assembly passed a non-binding resolution demanding, not calling, demanding for immediate lasting ceasefire. And what I think comes out of this is that it's very rare for two-thirds of the General Assembly to agree on anything. And one rule change that might work, because it's so rare, one rule change that might work is if the UN, through its membership, decided if two-thirds of the General Assembly agree on a resolution, then the veto cannot apply.
That would be a great advance, really.
It wouldn't strip away the veto, no. But it would mean it would curtail their use.
Yeah.
It would curtail the use of the veto in rare situations. It's very rare for the General Assembly to agree on anything, let alone have a two-thirds agreement. And I think that is an issue that many states are looking to explore, because we can't go on with situations in the 21st century where, very serious situations, where the majority of the General Assembly do agree on a line of action, but it's thwarted by one or two states in the Security Council.
If that were to happen, it would also, it seems to me, encourage the Assembly to agree more often than they now do, because they know, then they would know if they did agree, they would have be able to take some kind of action.
Yes, it would be an incentive to try to be more constructive. But the General Assembly must assert itself. You know, you can't have two or three powers, the United States, Russia and China, dictating things in a world which is interconnected and interdependent. And in a sense, the General Assembly, which consists of 193 members, they're not going to get a rule change unless they demand it. If you don't ask, you don't normally get. But I think there is a recognition that we can't keep staggering on like this as the 21st century unfolds. I'm hoping that might be the silver lining that emerges, as well as the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which is long overdue. I would hope another silver lining might be new constraints placed on the use of the veto by empowering the UN, the General Assembly, that when they achieve two-third majority, which rarely happens, that overrides any veto cast.
Well, I hope you're right. Well, Robert, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you.
And maybe next time we'll get together, we might be talking about the Chinese foreign minister.
Yes.
And I truly hope that your optimism is called for. Certainly, we need all the hope we can get.
Thank you. Yeah, it's difficult to be optimistic, but I think it's there are some promising signs. But I think what we do need from our leaders, and it's easy for me to say this as an academic because I don't have the responsibility of leadership, but I think we do need some moral courage from our leaders, because sometimes in politics most times you have choices between the disagreeable and the intolerable. And politicians need to accept they are going to make decisions which sometimes are not popular with everyone, but they do need to do the right thing. And at the moment, when you look at Gaza, there seems to be a lack of moral compass.
But
I think that's what's frustrating so many young people.
To reform the General Assembly, you probably need some country who's willing to stick their neck out and lead.
Yes.
And they wouldn't necessarily make friends immediately.
No, and that's why many of them are reluctant to do it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
See you again soon.
Cheers.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.